Excision number 12519, reel 3.
Air Vice Marshal McGill, reel 3.
And it's especially in the case of 2 to 6 Squadron on smoke lane. The times of turnaround and takeoff after receipt of orders were also of a high order and reflect the greatest credit on all ranks, both aircrew and maintenance personnel. Then the following answer has been sent to ASC 11 Group. This is from 2 Group. Boston Squadron appreciates your signal of congratulations and thank you for immunity from fighter attacks, which I think is a reasonable touch at the end of the signal. And that was the end of that.
Any other operations that stick out in your mind from the time you were with 226 Squadron?
Not particularly. I moved very shortly after that. I went to a nearby outfit, 180 Squadron, in command at Fulsham, also in Norfolk.
That was in January 1943.
Yes.
Can you tell me about the new squadron?
Yes, it was equipped with the B-25 Mitchell, which is pretty well known both in the US Air Force and particularly in the Pacific. It was slower and stronger but slower than the Boston, and in Britain it was confined to the medium level light bomber operation role.
What were they like to fly?
Very pleasant, a bit heavier than the Boston, but it was a very strong airplane. It could take any amount of punishment. It was sad, really, the way I acquired command on it was sad, that it was a brand new squadron and it had been worked up by another wing commander, and he was shot down and killed on the first operation of the squadron's first operation. So I was sent across within a day to take over for them.
And here you were with 2nd Tactical Air Force?
The same, as I was with the Boston. It was just another squadron in the same group.
And where were you flying from?
From RAF Fulsham, which is in Norfolk, and we moved down later to Dunsfold in... where Hawkers are now. And at that stage, they were beginning to attack the buzz bomb sites at medium level. We were getting good intelligence, and we were just part of the all-out attack by 2 Group and others on the V1 sites.
This was in the Calais area, was it?
Yeah, right along. And but we did one, which I think is, in retrospect, I think is probably quite topical, because it didn't get much publicity, but you may recall there was a suggestion of a V3, the multiple barrel gun in the part of Calais. Now, I don't think that's a hell of a long way from the thing that Saddam perhaps was playing with. I don't know. But about one of the last operations I led was I think we took 24 Mitchells in, my own squadron and a couple of others, heavily escorted by 11 Group Spitz, and bombed the area of Watton Wood, just inside Bardicale, which was allegedly the site of the so-called V3. Bomber Command took over with the heavies later on, and I think the USAF had a go at it. But as you'll recall, very little was ever heard of that particular proposition, even after the occupation of that area. Probably bad luck, but I never actually heard anything about it.
Did the attack on the V3 site differ in any way?
No, it was just a medium level attack on pinpoints in this wood. Watton Wood. So, oh. So we don't. I can't tell you whether we it was any six. It was effective or not. I just don't know.
How were the V1 site attacks carried out?
Ordinary medium level bombing. They weren't heavily defended, because they relied very largely on camouflage and landscaping, really, and they just went in formation, pattern bombing on the buzz bomb areas. That's all. The various sites, the launch sites, and the they had preparation sheds, and there was a standard layout that you could spot. The targeting was good, reconnaissance was good, intelligence from the ground in France was good.
How much did you enjoy doing those attacks?
I only did a couple, but by that time I was just about due for relief, and they were fairly straightforward. The losses were minimal. We had good fighter cover by fighter command.
You were squadron commander at that time.
Yes.
How did you like being in charge?
I've been lucky. I was a flight commander at the beginning of the war in the Sudan. I had that squadron out there for a while. And when I came back to England, I was a flight commander again. So really, I've been very fortunate. I did most of my operations in one way or another in command. And had nothing better than being in command. You don't have to rely on other people's mistakes. You rely on your own.
So you enjoyed the responsibility?
Yes, as much as one enjoys going to war, yes.
How much did you find the operations a strain?
It's a difficult one to answer, that, because I think if anybody who's honest will say there's almost always an element of fear and apprehension before the show begins. But particularly in the bomber role, I think, where once you've got your motor started and the job's on, you're fairly busy.
Did you ever have to deal with any LMF cases?
Yes, I did. Only a couple. One chap, a gunner, in fact, or one chap I remember particularly well, and I liked the man, and I think, in retrospect, at the time, I think he was a genuine case. He was dead scared of going to war in the air. He tried several ways. He came to see me about it, and I invited him to come along with me on one particular journey. I persuaded my own gunner to stand down. I didn't like doing that very much. But and when we came back, the chap said, "I'm sorry, but it's not for me." I think he was genuine.
So what did you do?
I sent him away. The organisations were laid on. They had an organisation in the southwest somewhere, and he was dealt with down there. What happened to him, I don't know.
What was your own attitude towards him?
I was sorry for him. He wasn't a coward. I mean, it takes a strong man, you know, in certain circumstances, to admit fear to that extent. He was an intelligent lad.
Was that the only case you had to deal with?
strictly speaking, to deal with personally, yes. But at the beginning of the war, I had a couple of colleagues that clearly decided that war wasn't for them. But I didn't think much of them at all.
They were different from the other.
Yeah, they were yellow.
So what happened to them?
They were posted away. They went in the Sudan, they went up somewhere other, and you know, you're pretty busy in those circumstances. And I only saw one of them years later, and but only for a moment or two. I left it at that.
So you mean they would have been capable of doing it if they'd put their minds
to it?
Oh, yes,
indeed. Yeah. Oh, without a shadow of doubt.
So that was different from the other chap?
That's right.
Who was just incapable of doing it?
Yeah. These fellows were... It wasn't as if they were, these two I have in mind, they were not pacifists. They just didn't want to go to war.
You told me what you thought of the Italian Air Force. Mm. What was your attitude towards the German?
Highly professional. Oh, yeah. Full of respect. Very good.
You finished with that squadron, according to your notes, in October 1943.
Sorry.
What happened to you then?
Went straight into the headquarters on the operational staff, planning the very operations that we'd been doing.
HQ 2 group.
Yeah. And strange enough, I stayed with them till after the end of the war. But I was directly responsible in the ops room and the AOC for planning the day and night operations by the squadrons. It was so exactly the planning the stuff we'd been doing before, which is sensible.
Can you give a sort of description of what you actually would do in planning the operation?
Yes, we worked in very close cooperation, obviously, with the fighter groups that were going to support us. Our bombing directives were received from the tactical Air Force headquarters, and operations were laid on a day-to-day basis, other than particular ones that were pre-planned in advance. And for instance, we'd talk to my colleagues in the 11 group, see what was to do for tomorrow, and the targets would be selected, and we'd arrange fighter escort as necessary, and away she'd go. And then later on, when the mosquitoes were doing the night interdiction, we'd lay out, again, we had a broad directive, and we'd lay on the areas they were going to attack by day or mainly by night at that stage. And it was a day-to-day planning operation.
How did you like doing such stuff?
Very much. I enjoyed that one. It was you're in direct you're directly concerned with the conduct of the air operations.
Who were you working under?
Basil Embry. Magnificent wartime leader. I worked him for 5 years one way or another. He really was a unique wartime operational leader, as you know his history anyway. But
can you tell me some details about him?
Oh God, yes. He was a great leader. He believed in talking directly to everybody, and he could only talk to anybody at a range of about 2 feet, and he had a blazing glint in his eye whenever he was talking about operations, and he inspired aggression, I suppose, and loyalty. He was a great leader.
So he was an enthusiast.
Oh God, yeah, he hated the Hun, he really did. Met few people who really disliked the enemy as much as he did.
Did you ever find out why?
I just disliked. Well, you know, he was a prisoner. He knocked down on Blenheim. He was a prisoner. And he killed his guards with his bare hands in one of his escape efforts. And, I think he just disliked anybody who was having a crack at Britain. But he was a firebrand anyway. And we had one of the Atchley brothers as assassin. That was quite an interesting combination.
Which one was that?
David, not the Snyder Cup chap, his twin brother, David. Again, a very bright man, came up with all sorts of original ideas.
Such as?
I can't quote any particularly, but he took a bit of reining in from time to time. And with Basil Embry, the enthusiast at the top, it was an exciting headquarters, I can assure you.
Where was this HQ?
Well, it was in Norfolk to begin with, and then we moved down to a place just outside Wallingford, It's now known as Carmel College. It's Manjewel Park on the other side of the river from Wallingford. And then we stayed there until the bomb line went past Brussels, because the range of our airplanes was such that we could operate from British bases until the war went further towards the German border. Then we moved across to Brussels. And we were very, very busy. It was a very hard-working headquarters.
Were you under V1 attack in Brussels?
Yes, indeed. The first one I ever saw early one morning, I looked out and saw one going down the road. But we didn't have too many where we were.
Down the road?
Yeah, more or less going past the windows. Went down the road.
At low level?
Yeah. Mm. Kept going, that was the main thing.
Had you had anything to do with the planning for D-Day?
Not the advance planning, but the detailed planning for the actual operations as they were passed down to us, obviously. Most of the detailed tactical planning was done, as far as I remember, and I'm talking about detailed, by the 11 group people and 2nd TAF, and we got our orders that way and the general orders, and we obviously had to convert them into the orders to the squadrons, simple as that. The actual date and place of landing, of course, was kept on a need-to-know basis, which is absolutely right, so that wasn't disclosed until pretty late on. But we did a lot in the softening up process prior to invasion, which meant attacking targets right along the front, as you know, to keep the opposition guessing to where the invasion might take place. But that wasn't of our design. We just did as we fulfilled our allotted role in the overall plan.
Railway targets or marshalling?
Yes, marshalling yards, railway targets. Some, if I remember now, some shore defences and that sort of thing. The mosquitoes were doing quite a lot of transport stuff. We did, prior to that, there were a lot of operations done to try and attract the, they were against legitimate targets, but to get the enemy air force up for the fighters to have a go at. But that was a well-known type of operation.
Was that very successful?
You'd have to ask the fighter boys that, really. From my understanding of it, not all that successful. The German Air Force were conserving themselves a bit, I think, and they didn't. I don't think the reaction was roused that perhaps was hoped for, but really that's only off the cuff. But there are people much better qualified to comment on that than I am.
After Brussels, where did you move to?
Well, the headquarters went up to Gütersloh in Germany. And I stayed there for a bit, but once operations were finished, because I was virtually out of a job, and we were sitting around the AOC's conference table one morning, fairly shortly afterwards, and the chap who was in charge of organisation was an older man, and his release group was one. So he announced that he would be leaving very shortly, and the beady-eyed Basil Embry looked around and said, "Digger, you haven't got a job, you're now organisation." And I didn't know much about organisation at that time.
What did that involve?
Well, accommodation, all the rest of it, on the organisational side of the group. And the beginning, in fact, of the rundown and the peacetime, well, occupational locations of squadrons in Germany. That was rather foreign to me, but you learn fast. That's the lot of a general duties officer. You find yourself doing all sorts of funny things.
Did you have much contact with the German population?
None at all, to speak of. At that time, it was strict, what would we call it?
Non-fraternization.
Non-fraternization. The answer was virtually nil.